there, everybody. And thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hale. And as always, I'm not in this wagon alone. The jackass dragging us is Kyle Filson.
How's it going, everybody? Yes, I'm here in Skeleton Studios, excited about today's show. You know, I'm glad we have so many fantastic listeners out there. They really inspire me to keep going. Every day I get neat and interesting messages sent to me, whether it's on Instagram or emails to the show directly. Funny stuff sometimes, silly things, you know, interesting articles, and it just makes me feel good. You know, I never thought that a decade later I'd be sitting here still doing the show and still having so many people interested in the same things that we find interesting, you know? So it's a blessing. So I appreciate everybody out there. I hope everybody's having a good week. Got a pretty interesting show today. We're going to be talking about some dinosaurs that were seen in the Old West, you know, pioneers and settlers and cowboys and things like that. Pretty interesting topic. I love the stories like that. But before we get into that, Cam, what have you been doing, bud?
Playing a lot of D&D at ReaperCon.
Yeah, how did that go?
Man, oh man, I had a good time. I was overwhelmed. You know, it was one of those deals is you don't know what you don't know. So I didn't know how to sign up for a lot of stuff. But when I got there and everybody was overly helpful, like it's one of those things that everybody's there because they want, and they're helpful because they want you to love it as much as they do. And I just fell right in, and that was the whole deal. I got to see a bunch of miniatures, and I got to, you know, meet a bunch of the painters and a lot of the people and a lot of really interesting vendors and all the stuff that was there, and then sat and played a lot of role play games. So yeah,
that's
it was
cool.
Awesome.
Was there lots of vendors and like workshops and things you could sign up for?
There were painting classes going on. Yeah, there was a lot of that stuff. Of course, I missed out on that because I didn't know how to sign up for it at events, but next year, I'm going to go back. But yeah, I'm going to sign up for a couple of painting classes or whatnot. But yeah, it was really, really, it was eye-opening because it was one of those things like we've talked, Reaper's been here a long time, right? And I had no idea.
Yeah, I had no clue. I wasn't into that world. So
it was, and then seeing
and
it
And this
now,
is an annual event, correct?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Yeah, very, very cool.
I think they've been doing it for like 15 years.
Wow.
Maybe longer than that, but I think
I always like it when you find these new hobbies and like these new clubs and things that you just didn't know existed. And then you find out that not only it exists, but there's a lot of other people already into it. They were there ahead of you. And I'm like, how did I not know about this?
It's to see the struggles that it must have been at the beginning, right?
Yeah.
Of like you trying to put on a convention and like 15 people show up.
Right.
Because that's all that knows about it. But yeah,
that's cool.
It was great. It was a good time.
I'm glad you had a good time. Well, my wife was out of town. She was in Arkansas with some of her family. Mm-hmm. And it was just me and the boys. Oh. And it was Labor Day weekend. So we had a 4-day weekend. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was just me and the guys. And I was trying to come up with something to do. And something that we haven't done before, you know, something unique. And I remembered that a couple months ago, I had heard about this place in Austin where they had these virtual reality games that you could go play. And this isn't like something that you know, it's not like Oculus and stuff like that you could buy at Best Buy. Like this is like really advanced. And I was like, man, that's cool. Me and the family, we go to Austin a couple times a year. So the next time we go, maybe we'll go this summer and we can go to Barton Springs and let the kids swim. And maybe we'll go check that out, right? Well, we ended up not going. So I thought about it. And when I was looking up a time to book the trip in Austin, I realized that there was one coming soon to Fort Worth. And I was like, oh, that's awesome. So this weekend I remembered, man, I remember seeing that coming soon. I wonder if it's open yet. So I went online. Of course, I found it. It's only been open 2 weeks. So I called up there and I was like, man, we want to come down there. And the lady was like, have you made a reservation? I was like, no. She's like, oh, yeah, you need to make reservations, especially on weekends, especially like holiday weekends. I was like, okay, cool. Is there any time coming up soon? She's like, well, tomorrow we're fully booked, but the next day there's a couple spots open. So I was like, dude.
Sold.
We'll do it. Give me 2:30. So me and Luke, Jacob, Caleb, and one of their friends, we all went over there to Fort Worth. And the place is called Sandbox VR. And I'll post some pictures of it on my Instagram account. But, man, it's really pretty neat. Like, I didn't know what to expect. You stand in this room. There's nothing in the room. It's like 20 foot by 20 foot. So it's like 400 square feet, something like that. Like, imagine like the size of a normal two-car garage. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, lined all around it are these cameras. And then on the walls, there's all these fans. So I'm like, what is this? What they do is it, you put these things on your wrist, you put these things on your ankles. It measures you in 3D space. So that's why all the cameras there, because it knows where you're at relative to everybody else, right? And then you put on this, you put this VR headset on, and then you put on the earphones. I mean, it's totally like you've been in this deprivation tank. Yeah. It's like that. Like when you go into that world, you're, the normal world doesn't exist anymore.
Ready Player One.
Exactly. And on the ground, there's like a red box. They're like, you see the red box, everybody? Yeah, don't go past that. What that is that's the wall.
You're going to walk into the wall if you hit it.
Right. So then they pass out these guns, and you have your choice
of
different
guns. That's the warning track that lines the...
Well, you're right. It is a warning track because it's not directly on the wall. There's like a one-foot buffer.
Yeah, that's the warning track.
And they hand you out the different guns. They have shotguns. They have assault rifles. They have submachine guns. Or you can rock akimbo pistols, right? And I don't know why.
But are they like real, like plastic? Are they heavy? Or are they just like a broomstick? Because no, it looks like a gun.
No, it looks like a gun, yeah.
I got you. Okay.
So they hand them out and everybody. And, you know, Luke, he's pumped. I'm pumped. It looks real. And the one we play, well, actually, we played two. Deadwood Mansion, I think, was the first one. So you're in a haunted mansion. And I'm telling you, when it looks real, oh, yeah, it looks real. And so Luke was pumped until it started. And then you could tell he was kind of like,
this I've seen apprehension scary. In Little Fizzy's face before.
Well, then you know what face he was making. But, man, I'm telling you, and it was like 30 minutes long.
Did he come around?
Yeah, oh, yeah. We had a great time. It was a lot of fun. So what's so cool is like if a door opens in front of you, the fans that you can't see kick on, so you feel the cold breeze. I mean, it feels like you're in there. And you can hear people screaming, cursing, because they're
out.
Next door playing the same thing. And I watched a guy who was trying to jump to another building. He ran smack into the wall. Almost knocked himself out. So they're not joking. I'm like, do not cross the red line. I thought for sure we were going to run into each other because there was like five of us in there. But yeah. We never did. It was a very cool experience. So if there's one located, and they're worldwide. They're in towns all over, so you can even play them in other places of the world. Do it, man. Take a chance. It's pretty cool. It's called Sandbox VR. They're not paying me to do this or anything, but it's very neat.
I've got to go try that.
Yeah, I definitely think we'll be going again, so maybe you can accompany us on the next time.
I may have a heart attack in there, just freak smooth out.
Right?
Well, No. I've got a headline for you before
okay.
you start.
All right, yeah.
Because I love surprising you with these headlines, because I know what draws you in, sir. And what draws Mr. Filson in is massive bipedal cryptid canines.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
That draws Mr. Filson in. Apparently, one was tracked and killed by a Pennsylvania State Police officer.
Oh, really? Well,
yeah.
Dude, let me see the pictures.
This dude must have been a bad man. So our homie Lon at Phantoms and Monsters knows how much we love this. This is what he popped in here with. Said he had got this sent to him. Now, it says that a Northeast Pennsylvania man recalled a bizarre incident with a massive bipedal canine, and it had killed several guard dogs and was supposedly tracked and killed by state police. It says, I was recently told by a friend that you investigate strange canine sightings in Pennsylvania. I live in the northeastern part of the state, in the rural Monroe County, in the Poconos. I have a bipedal wolf account. This occurred on September 3rd, 1975. I now own the property, and I still live there. My father and I were traveling in our family station wagon on a dirt road on our property. When we first saw this creature, it had come out of the heavy woods and crossed the road while on all fours. Now we stopped the car and just watched it. But when it reached the north boundary of our field, well, it stood up on its hind legs. It tried to hide between two mulberry trees. Its head touched a branch that was approximately 12 feet off the ground.
What?
My father would later measure its height. It then ran south, dropping down on all fours. It was running at an unbelievable speed, and it covered 100-plus yards and ran out of the southern boundary of our field into the road directly in front of us. From its nose to the tip of its tail, it covered the county road from shoulder to shoulder, approximately 18 feet. Its left shoulder was about 1 foot above the center of our car hood. When measured, it was 3 foot off the ground, putting its left shoulder at approximately 4 foot tall. As it ran in front of us crossing the road, it turned its head towards us, snarled, showing all of its teeth, and even its canines here, and it says that they were at least 6 inches long, and it had huge amber eyes and it looked plain evil. Says the neighbor who owned the woods where the creature had come out of had about 12 guard dogs. He lived alone. We called him Mr. Hermit, and he owned about 100 acres, which included several long-retired slate quarry holes that were filled with clear blue water and huge fish. The woods were also full of deer. By the way, our newly built home was about 50 yards west of where it ran south across the road. And a few nights after this incident, at about 1 a.m. in the morning, all hell broke loose. We could hear the neighbor's guard dogs fighting, madly yelping, and being slaughtered. Mr. Hermit opened up with a 12-gauge and kept firing. He would later find out that 9 of his 12 guard dogs were killed that evening. Our area was under Pennsylvania State Police jurisdiction, as there was no local sheriff or police force.
9 of 12? How many guard dogs do you need?
Well, he's covering 100 acres, man. Maybe he's distilling some things. Says several troopers showed up that night. Then at daybreak, a tactical team arrived in a helicopter, which landed in our field. My father worked the third shift at the time at Ingersoll Rand and was just getting home. He immediately walked up to Mr. Hermit's property. He crossed our field and then directly up the driveway. The state police refused to let him go any further. My mother was scared of the ordeal that we had heard the previous night, so she decided to keep us home from school. Shortly after I saw my father disappear up Mr. Hermit's driveway, small arms fire erupted. We were all looking out the kitchen window in anticipation of the results. The state police helicopter took off and hovered over Mr. Hermit's property. It then dipped very low and then lifted something huge wrapped in a tarp with a cargo net around it. My father soon returned and told us that the state police told him that he was to forget about what he saw. The barracks commander stopped in on his way out to reinforce this. We pestered my father to tell us what it was that they had shot and killed. This was the only time I've ever seen fear in his eyes. All he said was that what he saw them shoot and kill was an extremely large wolf. He never spoke of the incident again, nor would he acknowledge any of my inquiries about it. I've even eavesdropped on him and my mother talking about it after we kids were supposed to be asleep. He said that there were 9 dead guard dogs and that 12-gauge shotgun shells were everywhere. By the next night, there was a loaded 12-gauge shotgun at every entrance door with double-aught buck. My mom had a new handgun at the ready. My father got off the night shift very soon after this incident. There have been no other incidences with bipedal wolves in our area. M.
Wow. How do you get, I mean, like, I thought the dream of being a top-tier, you know, operator was to become a Navy SEAL or something like that. Turns out it's to be on this response team that eradicates Bigfoots, dogmen. Right. How do you get on that team?
And it's been around since at least the 70s that we know of.
That's crazy. If real. But maybe it was just a wolf.
Yeah, maybe. But there's, yeah, who knows, right? Who knows? But maybe the response team that you're talking about, maybe that is a real thing.
It could be.
Maybe there really is a cryptid response team.
They should make a movie.
Heck yeah, a whole series of cryptid response team.
Put on like Netflix or Hulu or yeah. Amazon Prime or something.
Because there is something that's kind of funny like that. I think it's called Wellington Paranormal.
Oh, really?
It takes place over in New Zealand, I believe.
Ah, using your VPN again. Oh, huh?
I'm telling you, I've got all kinds of good shows, y'all. All kinds of good shows.
Check this out. A listener writes in and says, "Hey guys, this is Mike in Flagstaff, Arizona."
What up, Mike?
"I'm 72 years old. I really enjoy your show."
Big ups, Mike, for being 72.
"I thought I would share a few experiences I've had and I have not seen mentioned in your podcast, at least not going back to 2020. Sleep paralysis is my first one. In 1972, after getting out of the Navy, I returned to my parents' home in San Pedro, California. One night around 2 a.m., I awoke realizing I was tingling all over and I couldn't move except for my eyes and my left foot. Standing at the foot of my bed was myself, looking down at me. The only difference between us was he was clean shaven and I still had my Navy beard. At that moment, I closed my eyes and started pumping my left foot, which released me from the paralysis and vision of myself. Now, trying to figure out what had happened, I came up with a scary thought. Maybe I was to have an untimely end soon and came back to my childhood home. I was afraid to shave my beard off for a while due to this thought. On a road trip soon after, I had sleep paralysis at 2 different motels, but this time no apparitions, and none since. In another story, another time in my life, around 2005 at 1 a.m., I was driving south on Highway 215 alongside the March Air Force Base in Riverside County, California. The base was to my left. Ahead about a quarter mile away, and at an altitude of about 500 feet, was a cone-shaped fire object, just as one sees when a jet's afterburner is lit. The odd thing about it was that its tapered end of the cone was towards me, not in line with its movement at all. It was moving from my left to my right, going across the highway towards the ground. It went behind a little hill and hunched over the steering wheel, and I hunched over the steering wheel, expecting an explosion, but none ever came. Driving on past this hill, I kept looking in the rearview mirrors for the expected fire of a crash, but there was none. Weird. Thanks for all you do, Mike. So, I'm going to say this first of all, since he's only been gone back and listened to 2020. There are a lot of cases where people have not only sleep paralysis, but also have sightings of UFOs. Like the two aren't necessarily connected, but there are a lot of cases where it is connected.
Yes.
Which begs you to wonder, is the sleep paralysis something more of like an abduction? And what you saw at the end of their bed wasn't you, but something, what I mean is a gray.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Very cool. I don't know.
Thanks for your service, Mike. That's awesome.
Yeah, very, very cool. Speaking of cool, let's take a break. And when we get back from the break, I'm going to get into some strange stories about dinosaurs, saurians, and things like that that are seen in the Old West by pioneers and early settlers. Stick with us, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. The last age of the dinosaurs is known as the Maastrichtian period, which spanned around 6 million years and ended with a catastrophic impact. This age was the final part of the Cretaceous period and the broader Mesozoic era. As far as science knows, the last surviving dinosaur was the Triceratops. Now, how in the world they know this is anyone's best guess. I couldn't really find any accurate information to nail down this common claim. The real question is, did all of the dinosaurs die out? Well, no. Not really. Frogs, salamanders, some lizards are all distant relatives of dinosaurs. And what about birds? Birds are basically dinosaurs. We now know that lots and lots of species of dinosaurs actually had feathers, just like our modern birds, only much larger. What about sharks? Some scientists believe that sharks are 450 million years old, which means sharks are actually older than dinosaurs. Dinosaurs emerged roughly 240 million years ago, and trees around 390 million years ago. What about crocodiles, cassowaries, crabs, sea turtles, and of course, snakes? So, if we know that that many species survived the last great extinction, why do we dismiss sightings of animals that are supposed to be extinct and not extant? Perhaps sightings of like Mokilio Mbembe, with a Loch Ness monster, or a gigantic snake seen in the Congo by a Belgian helicopter pilot are not that crazy after all. Perhaps they are real. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about some strange sightings seen by early pioneers and settlers in North America and the Old West. Earlier, I mentioned Mokilio Mbembe, Now, if you're an experienced armchair cryptozoologist, you already know what this is. But if not, let me enlighten you. Mokilium Bembe is the Congo's brontosaurus. Members of a German expedition in 1913 were presumably the first white men to see the dinosaurs of the Congo, but they would not be the last. What put these dinosaurs back on the map would be another sighting in the 1960s. A 17-year-old named Nicholas Mondogo observed what appeared to be an apatosaurus emerge from the Lekuala swamp in the Congo. This sighting and others would inspire several semi-famous expeditions into the swamp by a Dr. Roy P. Mackel in the early 1980s. Though he caught no dinosaurs, Mackel encountered enough witnesses in these remote jungles to build a strong case for the possibility that a few types of dinosaurs had survived into the modern age. So, is it still out there today? Who knows? Maybe. Maybe not. But getting to North America, you would be shocked by the amount of strange sightings that occurred in the Old West during that time. Let's get into it. Crosswicks, Ohio is today a largely unincorporated community, and only a one road, the old stage road, that passes through it. However, the settlement is remembered by more than a few cryptozoologists for a disturbing story from May of 1882. The tale tells of two boys having a deadly encounter with a monster while fishing at the Swatherwaite's Run, a stream that passes through Crosswicks. The story is unique, in part because it focuses on a pteropod-type dinosaur walking erect on two legs. As it is, most pioneer dinosaur sightings, typical of serpentine creatures that lived in the water. Ironically, in spite of this mystery creature being a pteropod, it is still described as a snake. Before the encounter in 1882, which may have resulted in the death of one of the boys, apparently a strange creature had been leaving footprints where it had crossed the pike for some time. Area residents didn't seem to give them much thought until it was finally too late. Now, there's an interesting article published in a local newspaper, and this is what the article says. Waynesville, Ohio, May 29th. Although this is an old settled neighborhood, and the primitive snakes in the main have long since disappeared, except the black, garter, and rattlesnake, and occasionally some of the other species, we are once in a while greeted with the report of some monster of this uncanny tribe. For several years, it has been reported that the track of one above the town of unusual size had, on different occasions, been seen in the dust, where it had crossed the pike. This report made the timid fearful, while the generality of the people did not seem to fear or care anything about it. And it has been reserved until yesterday to develop one of the most remarkable specimens ever seen in or out of snake season. And the story thereof is so well authenticated that the more incredulous of the neighborhood on big snake stories are forced to at last to lend an attentive ear. About 1 mile north of this place is a little village called Crosswicks, in which several colored families reside. Among the rest is John Lynch, who has two boys, Ed and Joe, aged respectively 13 and 11 years. These boys were at a small creek on the south side of the village fishing yesterday. After sitting on the bank a short time, they heard quite a stir among some old reeds, grass and brush behind them. And on looking round, they saw a huge monster approaching them rapidly. They screamed and, paralyzed almost with horror, started to run. When the snake, or whatever it might be, for they never saw anything like it before, it came close up to the older one and suddenly, throwing out two long arms, or four legs, seized the boy in its slimy embrace, simultaneously producing two more legs, these about 4 foot long, from some mysterious hiding place in its body, and dragged the boy some 100 yards down the creek to a large sycamore, 26 feet in diameter at the base, hollow, and with a large opening on one side. Through this aperture, the monster attempted to enter with the boy, who by this time was almost dead with fright and unable to make any resistance. Three men, Reverend Jacob Horn, George Peterson, and Alan Jordan, were quarrying stone a short distance above where the boys were fishing. And after hearing their screams and seeing the creature yanking one off, they hurried in an attempt to rescue the child. They reached the tree just as the snake, who, failing in its first attempt to drag the boy into its den, became alarmed, probably by the cries made by its pursuers. It unfastened its horrible fangs and dropped the more than half-dead child to the earth. The little fellow was picked up and carried home, and Dr. L.C. Lukens of Waynesville summoned to attend him. In the afternoon, about 60 men, armed with clubs, dogs, axes, and more, gathered around the sycamore tree and concluded to cut it down and destroy its fearful tenant. They began cutting when, becoming alarmed for his safety, the formidable snake leaped from the aperture, threw out its fore and hind legs, erected itself about 12 to 14 feet, and with the velocity of a racehorse, crossed the creek and ran up a small hill, then climbed over a rail fence, breaking it down and continuing north a mile. It was followed by the pursuers until he reached a hole in a large hill under a heavy ledge of rocks. Now, some of the men and dogs were so terrified at the beast's first appearance that they only thought of getting out of the way. But the braver portions followed until the frightful thing made good his retreat underneath the ground. It will be watched for and killed if possible. It is described as being from 30 to 40 foot long, 16 inches in diameter, and the legs 4 feet long and covered with scales, the same as the body. Feet about 12 inches long and shaped like a lizard's, of black and white color, with large yellow spots. Head about 16 inches wide with a long black forked tongue, and the mouth inside deep red. The hind legs appeared to be used to give it an erect position, and its propelling power is in its tail. Dr. Lukens said this morning that the boy, his patient, was badly bruised and scratched. He was horribly frightened, and that he lay in convulsions and spasms until 3 o'clock this morning, when he finally fell asleep, but frequently wakened with fright and terror. Yet the doctor thinks he will recover in a few more days. The foregoing is vouched for by the persons whose names are given above, and many more can be given if necessary. The material points have been furnished your correspondent by Judge J.W. Keyes, one of our oldest and most influential citizens. Now, that was from a newspaper article in the area, and apparently this thing, this monster, whatever it was, serpent, it had legs, whatever was seen, it apparently caused a big stir in the area for a while. It was seen more than once. It was seen a few times by several different people in and around that area. And then the story began to spread, you know, and people were interviewed even years later. And people would claim that their grandfather told them about the story. And, you know, it's kind of passed on as one of those things. But that doesn't mean that it didn't happen. Doesn't mean that it wasn't true. And there was a cryptozoologist by the name of Nick Susick, who found another story hundreds of miles away that sounded eerily similar. The most notable comparison that was ever made with the story of the Crosswicks monster, that's what it's known as, was a sighting from Oklahoma, which I find very interesting that places separated by such a far distance would have a similar tale. Crosswicks monster, I have to remind you, was hiding out in a tree. And this matches exactly the tribal legends from the Uchi Indians in Oklahoma regarding their sighting of their dinosaur. In a book that I read, it says, the legend was unearthed by author Adrienne Mayer, in her book Fossil Legends of the First Americans. It started in the year 2000 when Uchi tribal members were invited to the grand opening of the Oklahoma Natural History Museum. When the tribe members saw the skeletons of an allosaurid dinosaur, they recognized it as a specific monster lizard from one of their legends. In the spring of 2001, Mayer heard the tale from a guy named Jason Jackson, who was a notable folklorist and had witnessed the lizard dance of the Yuchi back in 1993. Now, during the ceremony, an elder named Jimmy Skeeter told Jackson the original story about the dance, and he says, the story goes that a long ago, a medicine man had just chosen three boys as his apprentices. The quartet traveled to a faraway land to conduct their sacred training. There, the medicine man took note of a peculiar, hollowed-out tree and warned the boys, whatever they do, stay away from it. But, like any good cautionary tale, they didn't. When the medicine man sent two of the boys out to fetch firewood, one of them went to cut down that tree. A lizard monster then grabbed the boy from within a hole in that tree, drawing him inside into his death. When the medicine man learned of what happened, he set a trap for the monster. He prepared a special medicine, or poison, and presumably stuffed it into a dead animal of some sort. The lizard monster came along, ate the poison, and died. The medicine man then cut off the monster's head and took it back to his village. The connection between this story and the Crosswicks encounter with a reptile with functioning forelimbs living in a hollowed-out tree is startling, considering it's a very odd detail placed in stories from different eras and in different states. I couldn't agree more. There's a lot of coincidence there. Why almost the same exact story of a crazy dinosaur-like monster living in a giant hollowed-out tree? So, if you ever see any giant hollowed-out trees, stay away. Let's check out another one. Moving on to the great state of Arkansas, which is a state that my wife just returned from. This creature was known as the Gowrow, and it was first reported in the state of Arkansas on New Year's Eve, 1897. It was described as a 20-foot reptile with tusks and claws. Check this out. It says, a Mr. Williams Miller, the well-known businessman of this city, returned Friday from Searcy County. Mr. Miller tells a marvelous story of a discovery of an unknown monster near the town of Blanco in Calf Creek Township. He says, for some time I have heard reports, more or less vague, of the presence of this animal in Searcy County, but I place no credence in its tales that were told. About 2 weeks ago, I was called to Blanco on an important business venture, and I determined to investigate the matter thoroughly while I was there. Immediately upon my arrival in Blanco, I instituted inquiries, and I was amazed to find that the people of the whole township and of St. Joe and Richmond townships were in a fever of excitement over what they called the Gowrow, which they described as a terrible animal which slaughtered cattle, horses, hogs, dogs, and cats. The Gowrow had terrorized the community for several months, but through numerous attempts had been made to capture it. All of them had been proved unsuccessful. The animal would steal down from the mountains at night and commit his depredations. He would break into cow sheds and kill and devour the cows and the calves. Several times he had been interrupted in his bloodthirsty work, but he always managed to escape, carrying one of his victims with him. I inquired why they are calling it the Gowrow, and was told it was because of this awful cry it uttered when it engaged in its devilish work. During the recent snow, a youngster who resides in the neighborhood discovered the tracks of the Gowrow while out rabbit hunting. Now, being alarmed at the ponderous size and peculiar shape, he fled in great consternation to a farmhouse and notified the inmates of the presence of the tracks. We formed a posse and armed ourselves with shotguns and Winchesters and started in hot pursuit of the Gowrow. We followed the tracks without difficulty for several miles through the new fallen snow until they disappeared at the riverbank. The monster had evidently entered the river and thus escaped his pursuers. A diligent search was made of the riverbank for a number of miles, which resulted in the discovery of an enormous cave, which was so nicely concealed under a shelf of rock and so completely hid by a thick clump of cedars that it had literally escaped to the notice of the inhabitants of the county. The ground had been worn smooth from the water's edge to where the caved where it caved into the rock, and though some ponderous body had been repeatedly dragged over it, we soon secured light wood torches and, nothing daunted, entered the cavern, where we were confronted by a sight which made each particular hair stand on end like quills upon a frightful porcupine. As the flickering light of the torches illuminated the erstwhile darkness of the cave, casting our distorted shadows against the shaggy rock, there we found countless skeletons and skulls of all sizes and kinds, many of them evidently those of unfortunate human beings, while others seemed to have belonged to horses, sheep, hogs, dogs, and wild animals that had served as a dainty repast for the Gowrow at some time. We scrambled out of the cave and concealed ourselves behind a large boulder to await the monster's homecoming. We had waited probably half an hour when we heard a ponderous splashing in the river, as though a great stern wheel steamer was approaching. And the next moment, a huge body of a sickly green hue dragged itself awkwardly out of the water and began wobbling its way towards the cave. Shall I attempt to describe it? Its head was ponderous in size and resembled somewhat that of a man. Only two enormous tusks projected over the underlip. Its legs were short and thick and terminated into a web foot, which somewhat resembled that of a duck's. Only each toe was capped by a vicious-looking claw. Its body was covered with enormous scales, while along its back bristled a series of sharp horns, which came to an abrupt end near the root of the tail. The tail was thin and long, and was provided with a sharp bone at the end, which the Gowrow would wield as a sickle, and when enraged would prove a formidable weapon. Just at this point, I gave the men the command to fire, and the men fired a volley. When the smoke cleared away, we saw the monster writhing in the throes of death, but he died hard. With his ponderous tail, he lashed down a couple of trees as large as my leg, and also cut off the leg of a poor fellow named Tom Brennan, who was formerly a section hand on the Iron Mountain Railroad, and last year worked on the section below Benton. Not wishing to see the monster suffer, I again gave the commands to fire, and this volley ended the Gowrow's suffering. The enraged farmers sprang upon the dead beast with their axes, and more in anger than sorrow, hewed him into pieces. I then immediately returned to Blanco, and the next day, having transacted my business, I left for Little Rock. That's the story. That's it. So, what are we to think of this? Did they see some kind of dinosaur that was killing all the livestock in the area? Was a posse formed, and did they go out there and kill the thing? I don't know. But it wasn't just a tale made up by one man. No, many people claimed to have seen the body. Many people came forward and said that they were on the posse, and they helped dispatch this creature. The Encyclopedia of Arkansas said that Williams claimed to have sent the body to the Smithsonian Institute, but it never arrived in Washington, D.C. An article in the Salina Journal in 1951 wrote that the Smithsonian denied ever receiving it, and Miller always insisted that some minor official up there probably embezzled it as his trophy. The editor who published the original story was a Fred W. Alsop, even said it was crazy what this thing looked like. So again, with the Smithsonian, right? Like, you've heard the stories, the conspiracies that the Smithsonian hid the bodies and skeletal remains of giants that once roamed North America. Now they're saying that, you know, he did send this body of this whatever kind of crazy pachyderm or mammoth or whatever this creature was to the Smithsonian, and then they said, no, we never got it. So they, again, swept it under the rug. I don't know if I believe that, because the Smithsonian has a lot of stuff with dinosaurs there. So, like, why would they? This is just another dinosaur. Why would they feel the need to cover it up? I don't know. Interesting story nonetheless. If you want to learn more about the Gowrow, you can go on the internet, search it up yourself. Check this next one out. This next one's pretty interesting because it's once again a sighting of one of these giant pterosaurs that was seen. And John LeMay says this about what is known as the Piazza bird. He said the Piazza bird isn't necessarily a dinosaurian. It looks more like a mythical monster than a pterodactyl. It was discovered by a Jesuit priest in 1673 along the Mississippi River in Illinois. As the priest journeyed down the river, he was startled by the sight of two devilish giant petroglyphs. Of the first, only a monstrous head remained. The rest had eroded away. But the second presented a strange quadruped bird monster with antlers and a man-like head. Now, over the years, other explorers would come to see it, and it was determined between all the reports that the petroglyph was 80 feet high up a cliff and about 30 feet long and 12 foot tall. The petroglyph was unfortunately destroyed in 1856 due to the disturbances from a nearby quarry, which caused it to shatter and tumble down the cliff. More information about the mythical beast was obtained from the Illini Indians, who called it the Piazza, or the bird that devours man. The natives insisted that the creatures were very real at one point and terrorized their ancestors until all were killed. Though they don't look terribly like pterosaurs, many cryptozoologists maintain that the Piazza bird could be an abstract representation of such a beast. Digging through various old newspaper accounts, I found a specific dragon legend from the state of Illinois that was based upon the Piazza. The article was from the Alton Telegraph, July 1st, 1875, and recounts a rather interesting history of the animal according to Native Americans. Some 30 or 40 years ago, I heard of an Indian tradition that had been related by an old Indian chief to the French Jesuit priests who traveled through this western region in the early day. A tradition that made a profound impression upon my mind, not so much because of its credibility as that of the Illinois Indians placed great stress upon it. The legend, as I now recall it, ran something like this. Down on the banks of the Illinois River, not far from the point where the stream unites its waters with those of the Mississippi, there is a steep, rocky cliff of considerable height, and about midday between the base of this perpendicular precipice and its top there is a hole, which, as is alleged, is the entrance to a cave, which, owing to its inaccessibility, has never been explored by any human being, nor can it be without the aid of a balloon. I cannot vouch for the fact of the existence of such a cave there, but such was evidently the earnest belief of the Indians who were here in the early days of our Western history, as well as well known to the first explorers of the Mississippi Valley. Well, according to the tradition of the Aborigines, hundreds and thousands of years ago, this rock cave on the river's bank was inhabited by a peculiar monster, a winged serpent of huge dimensions. It was the habit of this dragon, which in appearance somewhat resembled the Satan of our boyish superstition, to sally forth daily in pursuit of his favorite food, Indians. Emerging from this cave, he would fly out upon the plains, and watching his opportunity, would suddenly swoop down upon the first Indian whom he discovered. He would seize him in his talons, carry him off to his rocky cave, and make a feast of him. He captured and devoured one Indian every day and became a great terror to all the Indian community. He was their enemy. He was discriminating their numbers, and they knew not at what moment any of them might fall into his insatiable clutches. This thing, after many years of dread and anxiety, was becoming intolerable. Something must be done to conquer or destroy the winged devil, they said. Lest in time, he would exterminate their entire tribe. Finally, at a meeting of the tribe, 10 of the young braves volunteered to risk their lives in a determined effort to destroy the dragon. These 10 organized themselves into a band, and each of them, armed with a bow and quiver filled with poison arrows, proceeded in the right time to the vicinity of the cave on the opposite side of the river. They watched the aperture in the rocky precipice, and in pursuance of a prearranged plan, when the winged monster made his appearance at dawn, one of their number exposed himself on an open prairie. All of the other 9 secreted themselves nearby. The monster flapped his wings, flew out into the wide expanse of the low river bottom, and discovering a live Indian all alone, at first eyed him eagerly and hungrily, then concluding that he had his game handy, swooped down to clutch the victim, when instantly all the braves opened fire upon him with their poisoned arrows, striking him all over his ugly body. He failed to reach his expected prey, and now wounded and foiled, laboriously flapped himself back to the riverbank and re-entered this hole in the rocky steep. And this, so ran the legend, was the last that it was ever seen again. He probably died in the cave from the poison of the many arrows that pierced him. Henceforth, the Indians had no common enemy until the troublesome white man came along with them with the firewater. The Indians who dealt in Illinois when the first white settlers arrived here believed the story religiously, and possibly there was a foundation of truth in it. I have recently been glancing through some of the official reports of the naturalists who, during the last two summers, have been examining the natural history of the Great Basin of the Rocky Mountains, and find therein that among many other fossiliferous discoveries, the remains of just such a monster, that in the Illinois Indian tradition, have been found. So, was there a giant pteranodon or pterodactyl terrorizing these Native Americans in the early days, actually killing them off, picking them off one by one, till they finally were able to shoot it with poison arrows and kill it? You know, these stories have been told and retold from generation to generation, and were told and passed on to some of the early settlers of the United States. I, for one, believe them. You know why? We talk about it many times on the show. Like, why does science always dismiss Native people? Like, as if there's like their stories and legends don't matter, or that they're making it up. You know, I think it's a real possibility that they probably saw something like this. They had no way to explain what it was, so they just told the story the best way they know how. But at the end, what do you think? Were there actually some large prehistoric creatures still alive in the Americas during the times of the first European settlers? Or were these simple stories and legends made up and printed in newspapers in order to sell more copies? I heard both claims, and I certainly don't believe every story out there. But even if a small fraction of these stories were real, then that means that there at least were some saurians or dinosaurs that existed, and perhaps some still do. In the end, it's up to you to decide. Let's take a break. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. Back with Expanded Perspectives. I hope you like those stories. Very cool. I like those stories. You know, it's, you know, you never know if these are real things or if it's just been sensationalized by local papers trying to sell more copies and stuff. I don't know. I've heard both theories, and I entertain both theories, but I also think that, you know, there's a real possibility that some of this stuff might have still been around back then. It may not no longer be around. You know, we talk about this all the time with like Bigfoot. Maybe, you know, in the 60s when the Patterson-Gimlin film was made, maybe there were still a few of them left and now there's just no more of them. I don't know.
Yeah.
Or maybe they're there. Or when people see dinosaurs, they're not there. This is like an imprint. This is like a vision.
Yeah. A memory.
A memory from long ago. Or why can't dinosaurs have ghosts? Like when people die, we come back as spirits. Why can't dinosaurs do the same thing? Right.
You know what I love? I love any of these stories about dinosaurs, but I don't care for the dinosaur movies.
Yeah, I'm not real big on them either.
And I say that because I just watched like the newest Jurassic Park.
Oh, yeah, I've seen it. I've been with Luke.
Mm.
They took this is the problem in Hollywood, right?
They take something that's Jurassic Park.
Right? Great.
The first one was great. But I'm to the point now, I'm like, we're Fast and Furious in the Jurassic Park world now, right?
The larger dinosaur was killed by the smaller T-Rex. Right? It doesn't even make sense.
I need to get a little fizzy in here.
I don't think he really understands it. But it's like, why do they keep having to rehash something that was once good and ruin it into the ground? If you want to make a dinosaur movie, just make a different dinosaur movie. Like, I don't know why they keep making Spider-Man. Make a different superhero.
I do.
It's like when Stan Lee died, nobody keeps making new superheroes. They just keep using the old ones.
It's right? Everybody wants to create the universe, I guess, right? They want their own universe. I can understand that. I like the D&D universe, but all that. But also in the same breath with Dungeons & Dragons, it's everybody's universe.
Right.
Right? That's the thing. Right. I don't know. I didn't mean to make this a bash fest. I'm just saying I just can't get into the dinosaur movies after the first one. But I am a big fan of Jeff Goldblum.
Oh, yeah. Very cool
guy. That dude is cool as hell.
Right. Check this out. A listener wrote in. This is pretty interesting, and it kind of goes well with our topic because I was talking about, you know, how people saw these dinosaurs, and people say that's impossible. They can't exist. Mm-hmm. Check this out. It says, hello, Cam and Kyle. Does it ever feel weird to you to know that complete strangers think of you both as old friends?
No, not at all.
I've been listening to the show and loving it for years, and I'm finally sending something in.
Well, thank you for sending it.
Right? If you get around to a collection of stories about big cats, here is one for you. Now, Copamish, Michigan, in Manistee.
Where at?
Copamish, Michigan, in Manistee, had a big cat sighting just a few weeks ago, in August of 2022. The Michigan DNR conducted what I'm sure was a thorough and unbiased investigation and concluded that it was probably 20 or 30 inches long, you know, a really big house cat. That's what they basically said. Now, here's the thing about the Michigan DNR, which is, for those that don't know, Department of Natural Resources. They spent years denying an extant mountain lion population in this state, like completely denying, insisting that there were no lions and that all the sightings were mistaken bobcats or false, etc., etc. The official story were that lions were extinct in this state since the early 20th century. Finally, in 2017, a lion was caught on camera in Bath Township, which is just north of the capital and located smack in the middle of the palm. The DNR had to confirm that it was, in fact, a mountain lion. Now, there's a quote from a 2017 article in the Lansing Journal, and it says, I quote, even with this verifications, questions remain, especially regarding the origins of this animal. Now, a guy named Kevin Swanson of the DNR Wildlife said that this coup, they have assembled an agency cougar team, and they said there is no way for us to know if this animal is dispersing transient from another western state, like cougars that have been genetically tested from the Upper Peninsula, or if this cat was released locally. If you're wondering what the cougar team was when it was established, the answer is 2008. Yes, the Michigan DNR established an agency team for an animal that it insists has been extinct for 100 years. If you're wondering how likely it is that transient animals like from Montana would wind up in Michigan, the DNR never quite elaborates as to whether it swam across Lake Michigan or used the Mackinac Bridge. I'm sending this to you two because I had a personal history of working with the DNR at times, and their insistence on the absence of lions here was ludicrous. I actually heard a man confront a DNR director once. He lured him into a conversation and then disclosed that it was his son who caught 5 lion cubs the previous season in Michigan. That used to be in my neck of the woods, and it's about 2014. I was on my way up to camp, a campsite on the Iron River, and I turned on a dirt road, and ahead I saw a speed bump or a pile of dirt across the road. But as I got closer, the whole thing stood up. It was a huge mountain lion that had been lounging in the sun, and it reached from the shoulder of the road to about midway. This wasn't a freeway or anything. It was a dirt road in the middle of the woods. And while 2 other cars could have passed, you have wanted to scooch over to one side in order to do it. So that's how big this cat was. It lifted itself up, looked at me like it was bored and unimpressed, and sloped off into the brush. I specifically saw its tail. Now, a DNR agent later told me that it was a bobcat and that I was wrong. If that's what he thought, then I'm sure if he's ever seen a bobcat in the wild. Anyways, I'm sending this to you as big cat weirdness and to wonder at the insistence of government agencies that everything is not only fine, but everything is as they say it is. If it's true for the mountain lions we all saw with our own eyes, well, before we were forced to confirm it, what else might be true for? Thanks for you both you do, Michelle. She's right. This is exactly what we're talking about,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, spot on.
They're insisting that there's no lions up there, but she's personally seen one. She knows other people that have personally seen one. And the darn state has a task force assembled to look for them, even though they insist they don't exist. It feels like they're not telling you for whatever reason.
Well, and it from some of the things that have, that whole thing, but from some of the things that I have read and have gathered from those two that do that, a lot of that comes from, of course, they're doing what they're told.
Sure.
They're told not, because then it starts getting into, well, then who's responsible for the loss of livestock? Then it starts, you start making people have to be, you start dragging the state into answering for the loss of livestock or the loss of pets or the loss of things. So it's easier to go, look, we're going to deny it until it's forced upon us. Because they're one-off cases. You know, it's, and even around here, like people lose animals to big cats around here. But there's still more one-off cases.
Sure.
Unless, of course, they get in with sheep and things like that, of course. And then, you know, that's...
I mean, they're here in our county. I've never seen one. I've never seen a lion. I've never seen a ring-tailed cat either.
I've heard them and seen tracks. I haven't seen ring-tailed cat in years. Man, we talk about that stuff too. Horned toads, all of that. But yeah, I think that's a big thing, because you remember we had spoken to people that had talked about the wildlife officials in Australia had paperwork. And that they know that they've seen thylacines and found tracks and had all that stuff. They know this stuff happens. And it makes me think about the same thing when you start talking about big logging industry. It's like how much is being hidden, right? How much are they telling them? Like, yeah, they know they're there, but you better make sure they don't know they're
Sasquatch,
there.
Sasquatch, like how many people out there do know that they're there, but they just continue to say, nah, that's impossible. Yeah, right.
What if they know that's out there? Well, I can't stop thinking about the stuff in the ocean. I just can't.
Right.
Giant squids, all of them. And it's just,
Well, speaking of scary stuff, I've got a pretty interesting story I'm going to share with you. This was sent in by our friend Justin. Now,
listen up, folks. This is a public service announcement. This is a PSA. This might help you out one day.
All right.
In a thread, a Twitter user named Veronica tells a story about how she got lost out on a walk and ended up going 20,000 steps out of her way. She was hiking in the woods and passed between two trees, one which felt hot and dry, and the other which felt clammy and wet. Now, almost instantly, she said everything changed. The sun vanished, the trail dwindled, and the usual forest sounds either ceased or seemed as if they were coming from very, very far away. Then it got worse, she said. She heard a female voice call over to her, and it said, "Over here." And then it gave a terrible laugh. And chills went down the woman's spine. A moment later, the same call, but this time from a different direction. "Over here." And then I, a grown adult, she said, stood in the middle of an overgrown forest. I took off my t-shirt, turned it inside out. Now, apparently, turning your clothes inside out is a long-held Irish tradition to banish fairies. And many think that this is as effective as iron or church bells. Whatever the truth was, she said as soon as she did this, she found the trees again. She stepped out from between them and saw the sun once again. She said it was a close call. And she said that if you want to know, if you feel like you're ever about to be taken by fairies, turn your clothes inside out and run. So I'm just trying to help you out there. I've never heard of this, but apparently if you turn your clothes inside out, it chases the fae away.
It's gonna look, if y'all have ever seen the Goonies, that's what it's gonna look like with me. I'll be doing the truffle shuffle, trying to get my shirt off out of there in the woods.
Well, I could imagine if all somebody saw you take your shirt off in the woods, they would run away. Yeah,
100%.
They never talked about what this old gal looked like. I don't know, but that's interesting information. Take it for what you will. Maybe it'll save your life one day. I don't know.
Maybe she was taking her shirt off because she was hot, and the "over here" was somebody saying, "Over, look, buddy, this, she's taking her shirt off in the woods.
All I could think about when I heard this story, I know this is terrible. All I could think of is the movie Predator. Over here, over here.
Yes.
That's all I can keep.
Want some candy?
Anyways, thanks for sharing that, Justin. That's pretty cool.
I love it. You got to turn your shirt. Hey, that's good to know.
Maybe, but you know, also, how many people have they found dead, like in Missing 411 and stuff, or they found the kids alive and their clothes were inside out?
They were dressed wrong. Yeah.
Right?
So maybe that's why they found them.
I don't know. I don't know.
Maybe somebody on the other side put that on them.
Yeah,
changed their clothes inside out to get them out of the void.
Yeah, maybe.
All I know is from the rest of my days, when I go back country hunting, I'm going to wear my camos inside out. I'm not even going to start. All I'm going to, you know what? I'm going to wear them right side out, but I'm going to take the tag and sew it on the outside, because that tells me them sneaky little devils are looking for the tags.
Good. Right? How do they know? What if you have a reversible jacket? Then what?
Then you're stuck in the fairy world now, right? It's either blaze orange.
That's the thing.
That's it.
They don't make those anymore. I never see reversible jackets no more.
You just ain't looking hard enough.
Like jorts? Where do you get those at? I see guys in town. I'm like, where do they get those?
Give me some jorts and a reversible jacket. Yeah. If you're wearing a reversible, that's just another reason not to wear it. Like the reversible beanies and all that stuff. You just wear camo and blaze orange.
Cam.
Holla at your boy.
What else you got planned for the rest of your week?
Well, I don't really know. Other than we're going to play Dark Matter. Other than us playing the new role play game, other than that, not really much of nothing.
I got you. Cool. I don't know what we got planned around the house. Now that my wife's back in town, I'm sure she'll fill the weekend up with something. So I'm looking forward to that.
I've got to mow. I know you probably almost got lost after the rains, and I've been gone. Now you look, my yard's going crazy. So that's probably what I've got planned for the weekends. A little mowing, a little weed eating.
Right,
just
on.
Doing dad stuff, right?
I gotcha.
And just that's what you gotta do.
Well, if you want to share a story with Cam and I, email the show expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. You can call the show 888-393-2783, and you can follow us on all forms of social media. Till next time, folks, that's about all the time we have for this episode of Expanded Perspectives. Be safe. I'm Kyle. He's Cam.
Peace, y'all.